On Tuesday nights, we've been doing a class series about based on conversations with Yogananda, which is a wildly varying collection of direct experiences that Swami Kriyananda wrote down and then in 2003 put together in this book. So it goes from UFOs to the nature of creation to, it's quite fun. We've been on a long section having to do with the yugas, which are the great cycles of time to which our planet is subjected. And it's been quite a, goes on and on and on, but we finally made it through the yugas and we're out of them into something else now. But in the course of that discussion, this question that is always in people's minds came forth again, which is what is the possibility of perfection on this planet, and what is our responsibility for making it happen? It's particularly poignant now. I have made a policy for quite a few years of not paying attention to the news. I found that it would agitate me and then I would have no idea what to do about it. I would become more and more upset about the pure idiocy of everybody in charge, and I just wouldn't know where to go with that. So I finally realized that I just really don't have to know, that all of these many, many, many details do not help me because I'm going to be living exactly the same life regardless. And just as we are, just by osmosis, you get it. So of course I know what's been happening in the Mideast and in with all the refugees and all that's going on and the attack in Paris and very, very upsetting realities. And it's a very serious question for a person who has dedicated their life to God, which is to understand how we also then participate in the world around us. You know, what is right attitude? What is God's will? Are these realities proofs of God abandoning us or looking for us? Looking out for us, it's to say the least, intensely confusing. And we have to appreciate that a spiritual attitude is really more complex than sometimes we think it would be. Think, for example, I believe it was Lahiri Mahashaya who was meditating in his home in Varanasi and suddenly cried out that, you know, I'm drowning in the bodies of hundreds of people off the coast of Japan. And then later they found out the next day when the news reached them that some big ferry, I believe, had sunk and all these people had been killed. But he didn't get the news. His consciousness was so expanded that when that crisis began to happen, thousands of miles away from him and outside of any physical sight, he was as much in those bodies that were dying, and he was feeling their suffering as if it was his own. There's a story of Sri Ramakrishna, and there was a cook in the temple where he was living, and the cook was disturbed by a cat that kept coming into the kitchen. So the cook took a spoon and hit the cat several times to drive him out of the kitchen. And then later, when that man as a devotee came to Ramakrishna, Ramakrishna had welts on his back. And the man, being a tough sort of a man, tell me who did this to you, sir, I will take my revenge upon them. And Ramakrishna said, you did. And of course the disciple was horrified. He said, when you struck that cat, you were striking my body. And Jesus says, you know, when I was a hungered, you fed me. When I was in prison, you visited me. When I was thirsty, you gave me water. And the disciple said, when did we do that, sir? Because they couldn't remember. He said, well, if you do this unto the least of them, you do this unto me. So on one hand, that's the life the masters tell us. One more story that way. Sri Yoganandaji, master, said once, just in conversation, Lahiri Mahashaya was lucky I mean, can you imagine? How did the masters talk this out? It's like they're all like in the casting office, and they get their assignments. You're going to be born here, you're going to be born here, and they compare notes, and who's got the best assignment? Yogananda says, Lahiri Mahasaya was lucky. He said that during his entire incarnation, there were no wars. But Yogananda said, during my lifetime, he said there already been three. He went through World War I, II, and Korea. And what he's saying is that all the intensity of that suffering runs through his consciousness. So it isn't as if, and this is what we sometimes mistakenly think, that the way we deal with this is we harden our hearts with philosophy. Well, you know, it's all in God's hands anyway. This is just people's karma. Many people completely reject the idea of karma and reincarnation, especially karma, because it feels brutal. It feels like a cop-out, in a sense. You have all this terrible suffering in the world, and you just say, oh, it's just their karma. And then somehow that allows you, people imagine wrongly, to just wash your hands of it. But then we have Ramakrishna getting welts on his back when a cat is treated unkindly. So how do we put all of that together? Now, in the discussion in our Tuesday night class, a very interesting question was raised, which I felt at the time I wasn't able to get my mind around sufficiently. Because Master talks about the karma of a country. He says that by and large, for example, the karma of America is really very, very good. And he spoke of, and this is part of cataclysmic times and difficulties that the whole planet's going to go through and that this country will still go through, but America will come out well because our karma is good. He says the karma that we still have to pay off is the way we took this country from the American Indians. And that was the Native American karma. He said it still hasn't quite resolved itself in our country. And because it was a karma of greed, it will probably, I mean, this I'm saying, but I believe this is obvious, it will be acted out by economic troubles. And Master said, we will come into another cycle of serious depression because of the greed that has just been rampant in this country from the very beginning. That's how we justified what we did to the Native Americans. Oh, but we want what you have. Well, it's ours. Sorry, we want it. You know, we're going to use it. But overall, karma is mixed. So someone asked the question, well, does a country have a destiny? Can a country be perfected? And I just sort of stop and think about that for a minute. Well, if we think about perfection as Satchidananda, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new joy, there has to be an element of eternity for us ever to come to that state of perfection. Within our individual souls, within each one of us, we are eternal. This is the promise of the scriptures and the realizations of the saints. It's not something, certainly, that I can attest to from my own experience, but those who I have come to trust assure me that this is true, that there is that which in us, which is called the jiva, which is eternal. And therefore, when it is capable then of merging, becoming, realizing, recognizing its own self as Satchidananda. But outside of eternity, it has to be in the context of duality, where everything in this material world is always rising and falling. Well, think of the country of America. There was no America. Even a few hundred years ago, we're a very, very, very new country. The native peoples who lived here, they had a completely different name for it. They didn't have all the boundaries. Master calls them fancy frozen boundaries that humanity imposes on the whole planet. We're just looking at this country here. Master said one of the reasons he described Los Angeles as being, quote, the Varanasi, the Benares of the West, Benares being one of the holiest cities in India, he said Los Angeles was that place. a little hard to discern. And that's not just Northern California snobism, it's just a little hard to discern. But Master said that all great masters have lived here. There have been great civilizations on this very spot. But it wasn't then America, it wasn't the USA at that point. And what about the planet itself? Planets are material objects. They blow up. They just radically shift. The oceans go over here. The geologists are always telling you how, you know, this plate rose up and that one rose down. I saw some fascinating documentary about some 200-mile deep, or maybe not that deep, but huge deep channel under the ocean where all the plates came on top of each other. And who knows? Where do you pick out of that and take something so random as a country and think that it can evolve? Or even something so random as a planet and expect it to evolve? So we have to sort of stand back and look at it from a completely different angle. Our reading today is about reincarnation. Reincarnation is an essential idea that we have to at least consider very seriously. When I first stumbled upon it in my late teens, it seemed like a much better explanation than any I'd heard. And for a number of years, I just kept applying it to the situations that I perceived in life until it was just indisputably the best explanation I could find. And it shifted in my mind from just being a possibility to the only rational explanation. Much more gets added to it after that. But if you take the idea of reincarnation, and if you take the idea that that which is eternal is our individual spark of divinity, and each one of us is on this very long journey, this very, very long journey, human memory being short. I mean, how many of you can clearly remember 10:45 yesterday? What to speak of 10:45, November, whatever this is, 15 years ago? What to speak of 200 years ago? Human memory is extremely short and, you know, just comically unreliable. But nonetheless, we're on this very long journey, and we're on this journey of multiple experiences, and when we begin to wake up to it, and everyone sitting in this room is beginning to wake up to it or greatly awake to it, you would be, you have to be, or else you wouldn't be sitting here. We begin to ask ourselves, what is really going on here? And more we begin to understand that all we ever experience is the quality of our own consciousness. I mean, every time you have an experience, pause in the middle of it. This is what it is to be in the world but not entirely of it. Pause in the middle of it. Whether it's a grim, horrid experience, a completely joyful experience, an absolutely the mid-ground of drudgery that Helen was referring to, whatever it is, ask yourself, what am I experiencing? I'm experiencing my inner consciousness. And if it is crummy, my experience is crummy, and I call the things that I'm going through crummy. And if I feel uplifted inside, then I call what's going around me, you know, beautiful. But in all of it, all we're ever experiencing is our inner consciousness. And when we begin to get that, we begin to start working on it. We begin to start realizing that self-mastery is what I need when I have that constant battle between happiness and suffering. Because that's what it is. It's all about happiness and suffering, isn't it? This will bring me happiness, this will alleviate suffering. And we may have these grand ideas of happiness, or we may have reduced our expectations to very, very small. We may have responded to suffering by making our world so tiny, making sure that we never get disappointed by having too big an expectation. But whatever it is, it's going to be happiness versus suffering, and we're always going to experience it inside. Now, all of the scriptures and all of the masters promise us that there is a happy ending to this story. And that happy ending is that complete freedom of consciousness. But how are we going to get there? Clearly, we're not going to make it from birth to death. At least, I certainly hope, you know, at the stage of life I'm in, that I'm going to become a lot more free at some point. I don't expect to live, you know, as long in the future as I've lived in the past. I feel I've made nice, I've edged the story on, I've moved the pawns quite far, you know, across the board. But I think there's more, and I'm very much looking forward to having another chance at this, to get bigger and better. You know, this is nice, but I believe there's more. A tiny bubble of laughter, I have become the sea of mirth itself. Well, not quite, and I'd like to be. So this is where reincarnation comes. We get another chance. But my, my, everybody's karma is so complicated, isn't it? You know, it's just so fascinating to watch each other and see how personal every experience is. What I love, what I don't love, what you like, what you don't like, what pleases me doesn't please you. And, you know, I like Mexican food and you like Japanese food and you like tall people and short people and blue rooms, and it just goes on and on. I mean, that's the tiniest part of it. But inside this really complicated cycle. So each time we finish one of these incarnations, we have the opportunity. We get to go to Hawaii for a while. That's why, like, I think about the astral world. You know, we just get to go where the temperature is even and it's not really hard. Hawaii, as Swami says, before the missionaries got there, when it was really just relaxed and happy and not developed in an earlier, before this yoga really kicked in and started messing everything up. But when we reincarnate, we're there in the astral world and we're completely outside of who we were, of gender, of body, of nationality, of culture, and everything. And what we need is we need an ideal setting to help us to work it out. Because that's the only thing that's going on. It's not that America will become perfect or planet Earth will become perfect or the 21st century will become perfect, because none of that is eternal. And perfection has to be eternal, or else it's going to disappear. But the jiva is eternal. So I need a context. Master says when we're in the astral world, ready to come back into the material world, we look around. And let's see, this time I need to be, oh, how about a persecuted minority? That would be interesting. You know, let me be mistreated by everyone. Let me actually even be killed for my spiritual beliefs. Now that would be a good lesson, wouldn't it? Or, wow, you're just so eaten up with anger. You're just going to have to go out and murder a lot of people this time, aren't you? You're just going to have to test out whether or not pure violence is really who you want to be. And it would be nice for us to think that all those stages don't exist. But even as far advanced as we are, I mean, I confess to every so often thinking about picking up a big, heavy frying pan and just whacking someone upside the head. Wouldn't that be just a simple solution to the whole thing? Somebody came to me once and they were so upset about somebody else who was just behaving so badly. And you know, the person that they were complaining about was a little difficult to get along with, I admit it. But the person was just so irate. You know, it was like they wanted me to do something. I said, let's take that person out into the court and let's shoot them. Won't that be great? Then we won't have to deal with them anymore. And of course, we didn't. And it wasn't really a serious suggestion because we've all advanced past that point, but it was the same suggestion. This person displeases me. I'm not going to change myself. I'm going to expunge you. Right? So, all different levels of consciousness. Now, many planets are different. This is where the yuga theory is. The yugas come in. Yugas are different cycles of planetary time based on where they are in relation to the center of the galaxy. It's not spiritual, it's physical. When you're closer to the center of the galaxy, there's more energy and everybody's brighter and better. When you're farther away, materiality is denser. And it's harder to see the illusion of my separateness and that you can beat the cat and it won't hurt me. You know, that I can take your life and your belongings and destroy your life and it won't hurt me because now I have your house and your belongings. And it won't hurt me that you're hurting. That's a very low state of consciousness. And this planet we're on, wow, we've got a lot going on here. We just decided to come, and where we are, this is early Dwapara. This is the second of the four yugas. It's the beginning of energy. Energy is really happening now. But morality isn't quite caught up with it. We've got more energy than good sense right now. We have more energy than enlightenment. So we're just taking that energy and using it in more and more appalling ways. Now, that doesn't mean that those actions are good. And that doesn't mean that we just sit silently by and say, oh yeah, it's just their karma. No, not at all. But it does mean that perfection will never be found on this planet. And that as long as we direct our attention toward making them behave as I think they should behave, we can feel good because our ideals are a little more elevated. But it's still essentially the same delusion, just operating on different levels. That I feel badly, you change. And if I have the power to make you change, then I will feel better. So we get to be put on a planet like this one at this time where it's out of our control. Have you noticed that? Why are people doing this? And why? There's a marvelous thing going on I love. There's these lawsuits that have been filed now by children against governments for not doing something to save the planet. And there's been state lawsuits, and now there's one in federal court. And the purpose of the lawsuit is basically to put in front of a judge the evidence about climate change and have the U.S. Supreme Court determine whether or not we have a crisis, whether there's a crisis in the climate, and then force them to do it. And so this generation of people coming up who are Dwapara children moving into a new world are suing. And now they said that the fossil fuel companies have joined to defend against the lawsuits. And so I read this wonderful thing. They were quoting Gandhi. Because the fact that those vested interests are joining the lawsuit means that they're scared by it. And so Gandhi said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. And so here's the other side of it. This is a battle that seems to be happening on the material plane. But it's the same battle that is always happening on all the planes. And it's the battle between light and darkness. And physical force appears to have more power, but spiritual force is always greater because spiritual force is eternal. Material force will just have a flame and then it'll go away. And even if it destroys the whole planet, it will also destroy itself in the sense that it takes the people who do it down into suffering. And then that suffering in time, oddly, leads to enlightenment. And so eventually light always overcomes darkness. So when you read about, hundreds of displaced people or nightclubs blowing up and innocent people getting killed while they're having coffee on Sunday morning, I mean, the stories are horrific. And, I'm not Lahiri Mahashaya, I'm not drowning off the coast of Japan. But how can you be immune? How can you be immune to it? But the reason we're here is to be able to have more power for light than anything in creation has for darkness. Not in the short run. Not today and tomorrow on planet Earth, but for all eternity within our souls. And think about it. How many civilizations have risen and fallen, and what are the realities that continue? Buddha, Krishna, Christ, Shankaracharya, Patanjali. Everything else comes and goes. But But that which is eternal lasts for eternity. And that's you, and that's me. And the degree to which we look at darkness and have it be ever an ever greater incentive to take us to the light, then we are responding as God intends us to. He didn't put us here to suffer or to feel impotent in the face of darkness. Tests are given to us to awaken within us the infinite power of God. And only for that reason. We are exactly where we are meant to be, experiencing exactly what we are meant to be experiencing. And now it is our choice. What will we choose? What will we choose? Oh, children of darkness, forsake the light. Oh, children of light, forsake the darkness. Children of darkness, embrace the light. That's who we are. God bless you.